is commonly believed that C.S. Lewis was a theistic evolutionist. This conclusion is often based on comments Lewis made in his books, The Problem of Evil and Mere Christianity. However, a careful study of Lewis's writings reveals that not only was Lewis not a theistic evolutionist, but that he strongly opposed Darwinism, especially in the later years of his life. Stay tuned for my conversation with Dr. Jerry Bergman and our discussion of C.S. Lewis and Darwinism in this episode of Soaring Eagle Radio.
Remember that your failure to be informed does not make me a wacko.
The time has come, Dolores said, to talk of other things. Of shoes and ships and sealing wax and cabbages and kings.
My mind doesn't work that way. I got this real moron thing I do. It's called thinking. And I'm not a very good American because I like to form my own opinions. I have certain rules I live by. My first rule, I don't believe anything the government tells me. And I don't take very seriously the media or the press in this country.
Toto, I have a feeling we're not in Kansas anymore.
Nine most terrifying words in the English language are, I'm from the government and I'm here to help.
This is your last chance. After this, there is no turning back. You take the blue pill. The story ends. You wake up in your bed and believe whatever you want to believe. You take the red pill. You stay in Wonderland. And I show you how deep the rabbit hole goes.
Hello, and welcome to Soaring Eagle Radio. Your host is Mike Spaulding. Get ready to be challenged and encouraged as you consider today's news and Mike's commentary from a biblical perspective. Now, let's join Mike.
Welcome, friends. Thanks for tuning in to this episode of Soaring Eagle Radio. I just want to remind you that Soaring Eagle Radio is expanding. It's being picked up on other networks. You can hear us on the Prepper Broadcasting Network every Monday at 2 p.m. and 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. You can visit them at their website, prepperbroadcasting.com. Soaring Eagle Radio is heard on Global Star Radio Network every Saturday evening at 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. You can listen on that platform via gsradio.net. We're also heard on Red Nation Rising Saturdays at 4 p.m. and Sundays at 7 a.m. That's Eastern Standard Time. And their website is rednationrising.us. We're heard on WTTP-FM, Saturday evenings at 11 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, and Sunday evenings at 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. And you can listen to WTTP-FM from their website, www.wttpfm.com. And, of course, all the usual social media platforms on our website, soaringeagleradio.com. My guest today is Dr. Jerry Bergman. He teaches biology, chemistry, and anatomy at Northwest State College in Archbold, Ohio, and is an adjunct associate professor at the University of Toledo Medical College. He has 9 earned degrees, including 5 graduate degrees and a PhD from Wayne State University in Detroit, Michigan. His many books include a monograph on the creation-evolution controversy published by Phi Delta Kappa, a college textbook published by Houghton Mifflin Company, and he's been published by Columbia and Syracuse University Press. Welcome back to the Soaring Eagle Radio program, Jerry.
Thank you very much.
It's good to have you on again and discuss your latest book. The subject of our conversation today is C.S. Lewis, Anti-Darwinist, A Careful Examination of the Development of His Views on Darwinism. Jerry, you've written extensively about Darwinism and its impact upon cultures. Our last conversation focused on your book, Hitler and the Nazi Darwinian Worldview. And so I'm wondering, what led you to write about C.S. Lewis and his views concerning Darwinism? Did it come out of your work that you did with Hitler and the Nazi Darwinian Worldview? Or is this a separate thought?
It's a separate thought. Actually, I read an article in the Journal of the American Scientific Affiliation a number of years ago by Ron Numbers, and he had reprinted a lot of statements that Lewis made in some of his letters to other people about evolution. And he clearly had major problems with evolution. And I just filed it away and thought, well, yeah, it doesn't surprise me. And then I read an article by Dr. Peterson in the same journal, basically said the opposite. And I wondered, why would he say the opposite a few years later about C.S. Lewis when the same journal published an excellent article, which I fully agree with, a few years before that. And as I read it, I thought, well, this is naive. And so I thought I'd respond to it. So I wrote, oh, I don't know, 5 or 6 page paper in response to it. And the journal American Scientific Affiliation, which now they renamed, I think it's called Christians in Science, but they refused to publish it. So I wondered, what's going on? Mm. Why would they publish a good article that was correct and then publish an article a few years later that was wrong?
Yeah.
Well, it seems what's happening to that organization is there are more and more anti-creationists that are taking over. And they wanted a picture C.S. Lewis as being on their side against creation and in favor of Darwinism. And so as I did more and more research, I realized that he was not only against Darwinism, but he had a lot of very correct, tactful things to say. Even though, of course, he's not a scientist, he can't really argue the fossil record, and he didn't do that. But he had a lot to say, which has shown that he had an enormous amount of insight into the problem of Darwinism. And therefore, I thought, you know, somebody needs to go into detail. So I looked and looked and looked and found no book or no journal article that went into this issue in detail. So I thought, well, here's a niche that I can fill. And I simply did more and more research and talked to people and ended up with a 160-page book, which shows conclusively that he was a very strong opposer of Darwinism.
Yes, yes. And again, for our listeners, Dr. Bergman's book is C.S. Lewis, Anti-Darwinist, A Careful Examination of the Development of His Views on Darwinism. And Jerry and I were chatting before we went on the air about the book, and I've got to tell you, folks, this is a well-researched, very well-footnoted book that presents Lewis's statements in his various writings, essays, and articles, and we'll talk about some of those tonight. As we get started, though, Jerry, it might be helpful for some of our listeners, because this is something that I've become aware of lately, is that most people believe that they understand what Darwinism is, what evolutionary theory teaches, but once you engage them in a conversation, it becomes evident that they've only got a snippet or a piece of the puzzle. So I'm wondering if you would define for our listeners what you mean when you speak of Darwinism or Darwinian evolutionary theory. What do those terms entail specifically?
Okay, first of all, that's a really good question because so many articles about Darwinism and as well as negative towards Darwinism never define what they mean by evolution or Darwinism.
Yes.
And we call evolution, at least the modern theory today, Darwinism because he was the one that publicized it.
Yeah.
And therefore he's given the honor, according to the ones who believe it, of being the theory being called after him,
yes,
after his name. But basically, we're talking about, and I like short definitions which are pithy and to the point.
Yes.
And one of my favorite is almost poetic. It says, from the goo to you by way of the zoo.
And yeah.
People find that, well, that's not very nice. So, well, okay, I'll give you more scientific. From premortal material, from basically goo, and that goo changed in time as a result of billions and billions of mutations, which is mistakes in the copying of DNA, the code for our genome, to humans. So basically you're talking about going from materials, molecules, to people, all through, and this is important, all through chance, time, the outworking of natural law, and I should add, time, more time, and plenty of time.
Yes.
And chance is a very important part of it.
Yes, that's right. Yeah, well, that's a good and I've used that that pithy, memorable statement before, Jerry, and it gets the point across very quickly to what you're talking about. Well, it
and
wasn't.
Go
ahead.
Many evolutionists define evolution in such a way that we all would agree with it. For example, many say, "Well, it's just change," you have a family, and the family's a bit different than you. Your wife's so tall, you're so tall, and your children have a different height. Some are taller than you, some are shorter than you. So that's evolution, they say. Well, that's not what we're talking about. We're not talking about changes. We're talking about progression. In fact, sometimes they call the theory of evolution, they used to a lot, progressivism.
Yes.
Another term they used in Lewis's day was developmentalism.
Yes.
Developmentalism. Yeah. And that's the term that Lewis used. Mm-hmm. And doing research, I found that was actually used by many other people. And by developmentalism, they mean basically macroevolution,
yes,
which is evolution from one species into a very different kind of species. For example, a dog-like animal, they believe, evolved into whales. So we're talking about major, major changes.
Yes.
And this is what developmentalism refers to.
Yeah, yeah. And we'll touch on that a little later on in our conversation. I've got that jotted down to make sure that we discuss that. One of the points that gets lost in the conversation is that Darwin, and you, Dr. Bergman, correct me if I'm misstating this, Darwin was searching for a theory of origins of life, and so he came up with the theory of evolution. Now, but he wasn't the original intention, and this was expanded later by his followers. Darwinism was expanded to not only account for life, but also for every inorganic process, such as the stars and the planets and indeed the known universe. But was that Darwin's original intention, or was that something that was developed by his followers?
No, that, as you said, was developed by his followers. And teaching astronomy this semester, and it's clear we're talking about from basically, and this is quotes from several scientists, from nothing came everything.
Yeah.
And when we say nothing, we're talking about nothing existed, but from nothing came material things, energy, time. Time was created, mm-hmm, they feel, in the Big Bang,
yeah,
and even space. Before the Big Bang, there was no space. It's hard for us to imagine a universe that had no time, that had no space, that had no energy, that had no matter. But all of these came into being as a result of this idea, which now they refer to as the Big Bang.
Yes, yeah. Well, many people point to Lewis's atheism. There was a point when he writes that he just walked away from Christianity. He became an agnostic and then declared himself or described himself as an atheist. And some people point to that as proof that he was in the least a Darwinian evolution sympathizer. But the truth is that Lewis accepted by faith many of the scientific beliefs, as I was reading through your book, Lewis accepted many of the scientific beliefs of his day that were postulated by other people. It wasn't that he actually did the research to satisfy his own curiosity. He didn't investigate any of that for himself, so it's not really accurate to say that Lewis's atheism automatically led him to a studied support of Darwinism, is it?
Yeah, that's a good point. In fact, Lewis actually, from his own writings, we know that he rejected evolution first. Then I imagine he must have said, well, gee, if atheism is true, then Darwinism has to be true. And if Darwinism is false, then, well, atheism has to be
mm-hmm.
false. So probably he was led from rejecting Darwinism to then rejecting atheism, then accepting Christianity. So it seems
yes.
from what he wrote, and again, I'm reading between the lines slightly here, it seems that what he wrote basically indicates that he, first of all, rejected evolution. Then that led him into accepting the idea that if there's a creation, there must be a creator. And if creationism is true, or if evolution is wrong, then there must be a creator, and therefore who is that creator? And then eventually he accepted, of course, Christianity.
Yes, yeah. Jerry, in chapter 3 of your book, you list three common interpretations of Lewis's views of evolution. I'm going to give those for our listeners. One
okay.
view is that he was a theistic evolutionist after he left atheism. A second view is that he was a theistic evolutionist after he left atheism, but became increasingly hostile to evolution in his later years. A third view is that he rejected theistic evolution for most of his life, although he may have flirted with some evolutionary ideas, not necessarily because he agreed with them, but to make the point that Christianity could conceivably fit with some forms of theistic evolution. Now, your research supports position three. In chapter four, you begin to lay out your case for why Lewis rejected theistic evolution for most of his life, and you reference Professor Lewis Marcos's research into Lewis's life and thoughts on page 18 of the copy of the book that I have, and I'm wondering if I could just read that, and then I'll let you respond. But I thought this was a very excellent point. This is a quote. Dr. Bergman writes, "According to Professor Marcos, a major concern of Lewis was responding to those who attempt to explain all life by the process of evolution. Lewis concluded that these persons fail to explain why and how that process would evolve in us a yearning for realities that lie outside that very process and that cannot be satisfied by it, such as the existence of an afterlife. Furthermore, for his entire life, Lewis displayed a healthy skepticism of claims made in the name of science. He expressed this skepticism even before he was a Christian. An example is, and this is a quote, while still an unbelieving undergraduate in 1922, he recorded in his diary a discussion with friends where they expressed their doubts about Freud. In 1925, he wrote his father about his gratitude toward philosophy for showing him that the scientist and the materialist have not the last word. The next year, he published his narrative poem, Dimer, which offered a nightmarish vision of a totalitarian state that served scientific food and chose for eugenic reasons who should mate. I thought that was a great way to start off the argument for your support of position three, that he rejected theistic evolution for most of his life. I'll pass it back to you, Jerry.
Oh, yeah, he did. And I'm looking at some letters that he wrote quite early, again, before he even became a Christian. And he rejected it, but as I mentioned, he did, in a sense, flirt with it. We all say things that we don't agree with, but we say them to make a statement. Maybe other people agree with it. And then we may respond to it or we may not respond to it. And the statements that Lewis made, which indicates to some that he did agree with Darwinism, if you read them carefully and read the contents, you can see that he's saying, well, this could be the case, but I have a problem with it for these reasons.
Yes.
And if you look at his whole narrative, you can see where he's coming from.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Reading Lewis's thoughts, especially that last quote about scientific totalitarianism and eugenics and the scientific elite would decide who would mate, that led me to believe that he was one of the very first to understand the totalitarian bent of scientism in what is now called technocracy, which is simply a dictatorship of self-proclaimed experts. I think he did, and I'm going to follow up and do some research on that, but perhaps you could shed some light on that, Jerry. But it sure sounds like Lewis was a seer in that he saw where this could end up, and it wasn't a very good picture, was it?
Right, and that is a good point. I'm glad you brought that out, because not many people recognize that. Indeed, I hate to call him a prophet, but he foresaw what was happening. He could see where he was and look ahead in the future, and turned out to be quite correct, that he indeed saw, where we call it scientism today, indeed it's going to become totalitarian, like Nazism. And he actually used that comparison with scientism and Nazism. And indeed we can see that, the control that science has on our educational system and our many other systems, our publications, for example, science magazines. You rarely see any acknowledgement of the major problems with Darwinism, nor do you see even a tacit indication that there could be a God. So they're not even agnostic. Many scientists in their writing tend to be atheists. Scientific American, for example, publishes regularly each month article written by an atheist. But yet I know some friends who try to get articles, or actually advertisements, paid advertisements, in Scientific American, to advertise the other side, and Scientific American rejected the ads, and even though they're paid ads. So basically, we don't want to lead anyone who reads our magazine into the position away from atheism. Not even to agnosticism is that accepted, so by and large, at least in the vast majority of articles. So we can see where they stand, and that's true of most all science magazines that I'm aware of. They basically are mouthpieces for atheism.
Yes, yeah. You quote Viktor Frankl in a book that he wrote. Actually, it was an article. It was an article published in Encounter, and this has some age to it, and I applaud you for tracking this down. But Frankl quoted Lewis in 1969 in Encounter, and the title of the article that Frankl wrote was "Nothing But on Reductionism and Nihilism." And in that article, Lewis saw what science was doing to human beings, and he remarked that scientists have explained away the value and the meaning of humanity. And you write, "This sort of explaining or reductionism is contemporary nihilism," according to Swiss psychiatrist Viktor Frankl, who blames the complaint of meaninglessness heard from his patients on those who say time and again that something is nothing but something else. You know, I've made this point before with people, Dr. Bergman, but evolutionary theory, Darwinism, is contradictory in so many ways, but especially in our education system. And here's a very easy point that people they understand what I'm saying when I paint the picture this way. We tell people. We tell our children that, to borrow the pithy phrase that you use, that they come from the goo to you to the zoo. In other words, there's no real significance to human life. We're just a product of chance and time. But at the same time, we should be reasonable, moral, free moral agents and not bully other people. We should respect other people. Now, where in the world does that even come from if humanity is meaningless and we're just a product of chance and time?
That's a good point, and that is something I think that's something Lewis stressed, because he realized, taken to the obvious end, Darwinism basically says in the end there's no meaning on life except what we give to it each day. And I guess one scientist expressed it very well. He says, "Well, there's no meaning in life, but I'm hungry now, so let's have lunch." So he's talking about needs right now, but in the long term, all is vanity, which, of course, echoes Ecclesiastes and what Ecclesiastes had to say in trying to help us understand that apart from God, apart from an internal creator, in the end, all is vanity. But, of course, given our creator, all is not vanity. All is important, and all has eternal significance. Everything we do has eternal significance given Christianity, but dump Christianity, and of course, all we do has no significance in the long run, and much of it has no significance in the long run even now. And so that's one point Lewis really stressed a lot, is the implications of Darwinism and where it led to us, and that's one major area that he could attack because, well, he was a professor of literature and history, and that certainly comes out in those two fields, that concern.
Yes, yes. And that's, for folks out there listening, that is one of the primary issues that you want to bring up when you're talking to unbelievers or those that are holding even an agnostic point of view, but especially atheists, is to raise the issue, where does morality come from in an evolutionary system? And the truth of the matter is that it can't possibly have arisen within an evolutionary system. There's no mechanism for that to have developed in humanity. And so I encourage folks to do a little more research on that on your own. Jerry, in Chapter 5, you contrast a true atheist, Sigmund Freud, and his Darwinist views with Lewis's intelligent design perspective, and I'm calling it that, even though I'm not certain that Lewis used that phrase specifically. I think he used the word an intelligence. I'm not sure that he used intelligent design, but anyway, you contrast atheism with Lewis's intelligence creator perspective, and you utilized a book that I'm familiar with, and I was very happy to see that Armand Nicolai, who at the time, I'm not certain that he is still, but at the time he was a Harvard professor. And the book that we're talking about, folks, is The Question of God. If you don't have a copy, I would recommend that you get it. Jerry, how about just telling our listeners what was Nicolai doing and what was the result of what he presented, this conversation or dialogue between Freud and Lewis? And, of course, this was all fictional, of course. Let me say that. But a dialogue between Freud and Lewis.
He was concerned quite a bit with the implications of Darwinism, just like Lewis was. And so I think dialoguing with Lewis, even in a fictional format, brings out where Lewis was and where Armadi was as well. And so therefore, he's quite a well-known psychologist and philosopher. He edited several of the major encyclopedic volumes on psychology and related. And so he was a well-known scholar, and I think he realized in looking at children, rearing children, how important it was that they have a set of values and that they have a set of grounding so that they're basically can put their feet in reality and understand reality and understand the significance of morality relative to reality. In many ways, morality is just how things work and how things best work. So it's like fixing a car and understanding how a car works. Car has certain rules you have to follow for it to run for a long period of time. If you don't follow those rules, you end up burning the transmission out or the brakes or the tires or whatever. Well, life, human life, has a certain set of rules you have to follow. And we follow those or we disobey those at our own peril. And so therefore, following those rules is like following the guidebook. And when we talk about especially morality, I try to stress when I get into these conversations, indeed, that morality, morals were for our good. They weren't for God's good. God gave us morality because he knew that things would turn out better when we followed this set of morals, which, for example, he presents in both the Old and the New Testament. And so the same thing that this Harvard psychologist, as well as others, realized that, indeed, that life goes better if, indeed, we follow these certain rules. And, of course, we all know what they are. You know, marriage and having family and the importance of a father in a family and the mother in a family. And we know lacking one of those, like among certain ethnic groups, about 70% of the children are born without a father, permanent part of the household. We know what happens. I've worked in a prison for several years, and about 70% of the inmates were black. And the reason wasn't, of course, because they're black, but because they were raised in a poor environment and fatherless homes. In fact, one inmate, it sounded kind of silly when he said it, but when I asked him why he ended up in all this trouble, he said, well, I didn't have a father. In essence, it was very insightful what he had to say because he recognized what his problem was because he wasn't really with a father. He never knew his father. He knew there, of course, was a man out there who was his father, but father didn't care about him, and so therefore he had to rear himself to some degree, and then he related how he ended up getting in trouble because of lack of this guidance. And study after study has shown, of course, you need to have a father around who's a permanent part of the house, the household. And, of course, we know what happens over and over, not that having a mom and a dad home is going to solve every problem, and the problems are zero. Of course they're not. They still have problems, but the question is there are far fewer problems than if you're raised without a father. And, of course, that goes back to the biblical presupposition and encouragement, and it also goes back to what Lewis had to say because he recognized that you reject the biblical set of values and accept Darwinism, or the other way, if you reject Darwinism, you're more apt to realize that if there's a God there that made us, maybe he feels there's a good way and a bad way for us to live. And, of course, the guideline, the instruction manual for humans is, of course, the Bible. And that's what many psychologists who recognize this problem, basically they've said the same thing. Maybe a little bit more tactfully and maybe not bringing in direct religious connotations, but they understand the need for mom and a dad in the house and how critical that is. Not that you can't have a family of mother and the children and it turns out fine. You know, there are many mothers who do a great job raising their kids, but
yes,
it's really much more difficult.
Yes.
I've often said a mother who successfully raises, especially boys, but also girls, without the benefit of a father, should be given a medal, because
yes,
that is a really difficult job, and some have done it very well. But on the other hand, most find it overwhelming, and most find it very difficult to balance raising a family and dealing with paying bills and working and the other things that are necessary. So when you have two parents, the load can be shared, and it's much easier. Now, that's obvious to you and I and many people, but yet we see a whole segment of society that's not obvious, and that's not ingrained in them, and they don't see the importance of rearing a family with two parents at home who can be there and guide the children's development.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I agree completely, Jerry. I think statistics are pretty clear on that, and it's really surprising that more organizations who purport to support families and or women and men don't trumpet that and encourage
yeah.
families to stay together, marriages to stay together. Well, one of the things that I picked up on in the book, and I don't know if it was just my own impression or if it was a reality. But as I was reading through it, I got to chapter 6, and you talk about how Lewis, as he transitioned, I guess is a good way to put it, from Oxford to Cambridge, it seemed to me that he became a little more vocal about the difficulties with science as it was being presented in his day, and especially evolution. Now, I don't know if that was just a happenstance, that's just where Lewis was at in his life. But you mentioned Lewis's first lecture at Cambridge in Chapter 6. And I want to quote this because I thought it was a good statement, and then I'll have you respond. Lewis asserted that, quote, "the so-called divide between a dark and ignorant Middle Ages and an enlightened Renaissance is mostly fictitious, invented by modern thinkers eager to discredit medieval faith and thought. Christians and pagans had much more in common with each other than either has with a post-Christian. The gap between those who worship different gods is not so wide as that between those who worship and those who do not." End quote. I thought that was a very insightful point that you made there, and Lewis seemed to really grab a hold of the bull by the horns, so to speak, and begin to very forcefully denounce evolution. Was that the case from your research, Jerry?
Yeah, it is. And he, ironically, in spite of his enormous accomplishments at Oxford University, he was discriminated against, and he realized that, you know, I'm never going to reach the... You know, he was basically still at Oxford tutoring people as a tutor, not even as a professor, but as a tutor, although he was labeled a reader, I think, is how they label it. But he wanted to go up into the higher professorial ranks so he could spend more time research and writing and
yes.
and teaching classes and so on and not doing so much tutoring. And he realized at Oxford he was never going to reach that. And so Cambridge not only offered him a position, but Cambridge basically created a position for him. And so he saw it pretty clearly that, indeed, I'm going to have more freedom at Cambridge. And he kind of let the Cambridge dons know that, indeed, I'm going to use this freedom.
Mm-hmm.
And he did, and that speech he gave is one example of where he used his freedom. So I think it reduced fear. It opened the door for him to be able to express himself, his ideas much more strongly, but yet still tactfully, but much more strongly than he was able to do at Oxford. I think at Oxford he thought, well, I'll lay low for a while, and I'll get promoted, and I'll go and move into a better position, and things will be better. But it never happened, and when he realized it wasn't going to happen, then he was able to fortunately go to Cambridge. And ironically, though, even though he was at Cambridge as a professor there, he still liked Oxford, and he still lived in Oxford until he died. And so still loved Oxford, but he felt more at home and had more freedom at Cambridge, which I think is kind of a negative commentary on Oxford compared to Cambridge.
Yes, I agree with that. Well, as Lewis's thought developed, he began to define Darwinism as a great myth. I think that's the way that he coined it, a great myth. And he often referred to naturalistic theories of evolutionary development as you mentioned previously, developmentalism. Lewis saw a clear contradiction in Darwinism, and he began to argue against it as a self-refuting belief system that contradicted both fact and reason, didn't he?
Oh, yeah, he did. And he recognized he couldn't debate as a scientist, but he recognized the core problem, and he just kind of avoided skipped over some of the scientific stuff that we like to talk about, like the fossil record and abiogenesis and so on, and cut right to the heart of the chase. And
yes,
that was basically the implications of Darwinism, or as he put it, developmentalism, that was the problem. And at least three of his novels really focused on that theme. And if you read them carefully, you can see that. This is what the quote you read earlier from this professor who commented on my book,
yes,
he recognizes just by reading the novels. And when I sent him my manuscript, he read it through. He said, well, this supports what I saw in between the lines in the novels that I read.
Mm-hmm.
And now you've brought it out, indeed, that indeed you show that he had a strong concern about the harm where scientism was leading us. And the solution was, of course, to not recognize scientism as the ultimate authority and to basically move beyond scientism, or as we say today, or as he said, actually, developmentalism, and that's what he encouraged people to do.
Yeah, yeah. Lewis was certainly an intellectual giant in his day, but he also drew encouragement and inspiration from others, other peers, and I was so glad to see you mentioned G.K. Chesterton's Everlasting Man as having an impact on Lewis.
Right, and yeah, he had a major impact, as well as others. In fact, the number of people that had an impact on him basically presented Christianity in the form of a story. And they used literature to basically explain Christianity. And he basically adopted that position as well, because that was so effective for him. And he was so thankful for ones who did work by presenting the gospel in a storyline, in a story. And, of course, that's not original. Christ himself used parables to explain the truth. And so he himself then followed this model, and basically almost all the stuff he wrote was stories, which turned out to be not only enormously successful, but also enormously useful in helping other people understand, well, as he said, mere Christianity. So it turned out to be successful in selling books, but also successful in his end goal, which is to help people transfer themselves from non-belief, as he was, to belief, as he likewise was transferred as well.
Yes, yes. In chapter 7, Jerry, you deal with the moral argument, and I was going to just skip this, but I thought, you know what, this is too good to, because we'd already kind of touched on it, but I would like to share this and then hear your comments, but sharing it more for our listeners, because this is a powerful section. Pages 40 and 41 in the copy of your book that I have, you quote from Eric Weilenberg's book, God and the Reach of Reason, C.S. Lewis, David Hume, and Bertrand Russell. And this is what you have to say, and please bear with me. This is a lengthy quote, but it's well worth the minute or so to read. Well, that might be optimistic, maybe 2 minutes.
Okay.
Lewis's evidence for the design argument is primarily the moral argument, as is obvious in his explanation of the moral argument. Specifically, Lewis believes that the best evidence of the existence of God is moral phenomena. That proves the existence of a higher power that created the universe. The higher power issues instructions and wants us to engage in morally right conduct. Then there is a good mind-like higher power that created the universe. Weilenberg, from his intensive study of Lewis, concluded that Lewis believed that every person possesses, and this is a quote, a supernatural capacity reason, which enables us to have genuine knowledge, human reason must have some source, and since it has already been established that human reason cannot have been produced by nature, it must have a supernatural source. The supernatural source turns out to be God. Human minds, then, are not the only supernatural entities that exist. They do not come from nowhere. Each has come into nature from supernature. Each has its taproot in an eternal, self-existent, rational being whom we call God. Human thought is God kindles. Now, on page 41, then, you write this, and this is Dr. Bergman's writing, and he lays this out very well. Thus, God designed humans to be moral, and Lewis's argument for God to support this view from reason is as follows. Point number one, and this looks like a rather long syllogism, premise and conclusions, but it's very powerful. So, folks, just grab a hold of this. Better yet, get a copy of the book, C.S. Lewis, Anti-Darwinist, by Dr. Jerry Bergman. Page 41 says this, point number one, if naturalism is true, then knowledge exists only if natural selection could produce a capacity for knowledge. And here he means wisdom, starting with creatures with no such capacity. That's an excellent point right off the bat. Point number two, but natural selection could not produce a capacity for knowledge, starting with creatures with no such capacity. Point number three, so if naturalism is true, then knowledge does not exist. We derive that from points number one and two. Point number four, but knowledge does exist. Point number five, so naturalism is false, and we derive that from points three and four. Point number six, if knowledge exists and naturalism is false, then there is a supernatural, eternal, self-existent, rational being that is the ultimate source of all knowledge. Final point, point number seven, therefore, there is a supernatural, eternal, self-existent, rational being that is the ultimate source of all knowledge, and that is derived from points four, five, and six. In short, Dr. Bergman writes, Lewis rejected evolution because he concluded that it is not conceivable that evolutionary processes could produce creatures capable of knowledge from creatures incapable of knowledge, end quote. That, Jerry, is worth the price of the book right there. That's some powerful stuff. If folks will just grab a hold of the power in that argument, I don't know that there's an atheist out there, including Richard Dawkins, that could answer that truthfully and satisfactorily and reasonably.
Right, but they attempt to now.
They attempt
to come up with reasons.
Yes.
But the reasons, if you think about it, though, are not, they don't hold up when you think about the whole situation.
Yes. So that's absolutely right.
Powerful. And others have understood that as well. Many others, well, Mortimer Adler is a good example where he realized that.
Yes.
Evolution is going to produce a certain kind of world. Basically, survival of the fittest is going to produce a certain mindset.
Mm-hmm.
Survival, me
yes.
first,
yes.
and stepping on you. And in the long run, you can see that that's not there because so many people, just today, I had a student mention to me after class that her mother had just given her kidney to someone, went through that horrible operation, which is risky,
yes.
and donated her kidney. And so I asked the student, did your mother know the person? And she said, no, she never met her. And him, in this case, the kidney was given to a male. And, well, why did she do this? Well, she just felt it's something that she should do. If she needed a kidney and someone gave her one, she would be very grateful. So she was basically putting herself in someone else's place. She didn't know this someone else. She knows him now.
Mm-hmm.
She's met him now after the operation is completed and successful. But on the other hand, there are millions of people who donate of their own free will, nothing to gain. They give their kidney. Well, Darwinists would say, no, life has to be maintained.
Yes.
I got to maintain my life so I can pass mm-hmm. my genes on. So therefore, evolution would select people who don't donate their kidneys.
Right.
And therefore... you can see that in many other cases as
yes.
well, in many other situations, but that's a...
Yeah, that's a good example. good example of what you were talking about there. Well, in chapters 8 and 9, you document Lewis's rejection of theistic evolution, and those were really strong chapters, Jerry, to prove your point that Lewis was not a theistic evolutionist, as some say that he was. And you cover the writings of Henry Bergson and Pierre Teilhard de Chardin. Lewis described Bergson's views, and I actually laughed out loud when I read this, Jerry, and I'm going to try to pronounce it without stammering or stuttering, but it was a great line. Lewis described Bergson's views as pantheistic bio-adulterous waffles. That's a great line. That is a great line. And
he had
a way with words, for sure.
Against.
Yes.
Yeah, he had a lot to say against theistic evolution. So
yes.
He couldn't have been one.
Right. That's exactly right. Now, de Chardin's thinking, Lewis described as mystical evolution run mad.
Right.
So
yeah.
Clearly, he was hostile to the whole idea of theistic evolution.
Right.
Yeah.
He saw it as a major contradiction. It's trying to hold two things which are clearly contradictory. You can't do it.
That's right. Yeah. Well, Lewis is famous for a lot of books, and in our time, perhaps none of them more so than The Chronicles of Narnia. In chapter 10 of your book, Jerry, you argue that Lewis's creation worldview was on full display, notably in The Magician's Nephew, is one of the books in the Narnia series. Lewis portrayed through literature a literal fall that affected all of creation, didn't he?
Right, he did, yeah.
Yeah. You devote chapter 11 to analyzing some of the statements that people have pointed to that they believe indicates Lewis was a theistic evolutionist. But when taken in context, those statements actually say something much different. And that's an important point to remember for folks when they're reading information or reading books or articles that suggest something about Lewis and his evolutionary viewpoints. Make sure that you check the context, the original, what Lewis was writing and saying, because I think what people will find, Jerry, is that that's been taken out of context, and Lewis was really saying no such thing.
Yeah, right. That's true.
Yeah. In chapter 15, which you title, Lewis Becomes a Militant Anti-Darwinist, you zero in on Lewis's really his essential point that scientific naturalism can't explain life. And you give some time to discuss the development of the brain, the mind, thinking, reasoning, and so on. And you follow that up then in chapter 16, discussing Lewis's essay that he titled The Funeral of the Great Myth. I'm wondering if you would discuss that for us.
Yeah, the great myth, of course, was Darwinism or evolutionism, and he felt it eventually will have to self-destruct because it just doesn't describe reality, and it doesn't help us understand reality, and I wonder, why hasn't it self-destructed already? I do a lot of reading. I read about a book a week, and I'm reading a book now which, 700 pages on genetics? It's just titled Genetics and the History of an Idea.
Wow.
And as the person who wrote this is an evolutionist, but as you read what he wrote over and over, it's clear that the facts that he points out is simply not in harmony with his worldview. And he kind of recognizes that in places, but he says, well, we're the result of lots of mutations, we're the result of billions of mistakes, but it's got to be a few that are helpful which help us evolve to become what we are. But if you think about it, we're swamped by negative mutations. How are a few that are helpful going to help in the long run? It's like climbing up a mountain. We go up 1 foot and slip back 10 feet and then go up another foot and again slip back 10 feet. So
yes.
Basically you're never going to get to humans or any life by the accumulation of billions of mistakes. And he points out that this is there, these mistakes are there, In fact, much of the book is about these mistakes, but yet he doesn't lead us to the final conclusion that we can't be the result of billions of mistakes. We must be the result of intelligent design, and billions of mistakes must do the opposite. They must not create, improve, they must deteriorate. And that's exactly what we see. In fact, he brings out now that there is about 25,000 different mutational-caused diseases as a result of the accumulation of mutations. And he points out correctly that the number of mutations in humans is going up steadily. Well, how can you harmonize that with Darwinism? You can't.
You can't.
Darwinism says the opposite.
Yeah.
And so he just doesn't seem to realize where all his good material is leading.
Yes, yeah, yeah. And that's one of the blind spots, isn't it, for most that are given over to Darwinian worldview. They for whatever reason, the evidence is right there. They even write about it. The example you've just shared with our listeners is a perfect case in point. It's very obvious that the worldview they're subscribing to is not based on the evidence that is coming from their own pen. And that's quite a surprising thing. But well, one of the things, and we talked about this in our first conversation, Jerry, dealing with Hitler and the Nazi Darwinian worldview. But one of the consequences of Darwinism is eugenics, a lack of compassion or a lack of acceptance, might be a better way to say it, of the sanctity of human life. Eugenics is one of the rotten fruits of Darwinism that Lewis recognized very early on, and as I've read on this subject, he was one of the first to forcefully talk about it and call it out as a consequence of Darwinism. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, he was. He did point it out very successfully. In fact, this book I just mentioned, titled Genetics, and I'm amazed at how much information he has in the book about eugenics and about the harm that our understanding of the genome has led us to, and he does a really good job, excellent job, talking about the harm that indeed this has caused. Of course, he condemns it and says it's abusing evolution, but on the other hand, the obvious implications, it's obvious that evolution leads us to survival of the fittest, and therefore elimination of the weaker is one way of improving society.
Yes, yeah. In chapter 18, Jerry, and for our listeners, there are 19 chapters. Chapter 19 is some conclusions where Dr. Bergman sums up all that he's discussed in this book. And again, the book is C.S. Lewis, Anti-Darwinist, and I'm sure that you can get this on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, any of those locations.
Any of the websites.
Any of the websites that have it. But in chapter 18, you demonstrate that Lewis's concerns were well-founded, and we've touched on this earlier, but I'd like to conclude with this thought because it's timely, it's relevant to today, where we're at and what we're seeing. There is a push today with the force of government behind it, even the United Nations, to force every nation to adhere to proposed laws and regulations concerning a whole range of things. It's been, in fact, suggested by numerous government officials here in America that those who deny certain scientific sacred cows, and we could talk about climate change or some other things, those who deny these so-called scientific facts should be censored and even punished. And I think that that places us squarely in the future that Lewis envisioned. What do you think?
Well, yeah, that's very true, and I've written three books, basically, on what deal with this topic, and one is called Slaughter of the Dissidents, and the other is called Silencing the Darwin Dissidents, and the third volume is called Censoring the Darwin Dissidents, and I'm working, actually, on several others, and each volume is about 400 pages, and I have about 1,000 footnotes for each chapter, so I've eloquently demonstrated, indeed, that if you dare to question Darwinism in the schools today, you could end up in trouble. And the three books basically talk about all the trouble you can end up in because of questioning Darwinism. That is one thing you don't do. There are certain principles in America that are very important in educational system likewise, and one of those is you do not question or encourage students to question Darwinism. It's the sacred cow of academia. And that's exactly what Lewis was concerned about, and indeed, it has been fulfilled to a greater extent, I think, than even he envisioned in his day in the 60s when he was writing in this area.
Yeah. Well, I was not aware of those books, but I've got to get my hands on copies of those, Jerry, and maybe we can loop back at some point in the near future and have a conversation about those books, because there is a lot of relevant information what's happening today, and I appreciate you writing on those subjects. That's not something that a lot of folks in your position would be willing to do, so I applaud you for doing that. Well, I know you're always reading, you're always writing books. It's as we've discussed off air, it's a nonstop process. But I'm going to ask the question anyway, Jerry. Any new projects you're working on? Any new books that are coming out? Last time I asked that question, you said C.S. Lewis, and that's why we're talking now. But
right, just as you called, I was working on a book called "Darwinism is the Doorway to Atheism." And I have 52 cases because there's 52 weeks in a year. I thought I'd stop it at 52. I could have had 100, but I don't want to overdo the subject. But basically, I'm looking at how in so many cases, well-known people like Albert Einstein and Sigmund Freud and so many other people, well-known founders of the communist movement, Lenin and Stalin and so on, and Hitler as well, and Darwin as well.
Yeah.
All of these people were originally at least raised in a Christian environment, and claim to have accepted Christianity, and all ended up leaving in the cases that I selected, of course, to reject theism and accept atheism. And a major, if not the major, factor in all these cases I looked at was the acceptance of Darwinism. It's kind of a, you start out a believer, or at least claim to be such, and then you learn about Darwin, and then you become a Darwinist and an atheist. And each chapter basically shows this progression in how people came from a Christian worldview, rejected that, and accepted a Darwinian worldview. And this includes not only infamous Nazis and eugenicists, but also well-known people today. Well, I mentioned Sigmund Freud and Adolf Hitler and many others, which you would recognize.
Nice.
And I tend to pick people who are well-known, well-recognized, because I'm not didn't want to focus on people who were less important. I wanted to show, indeed, this was important in the changes in the world, which have occurred in the past 100 years or so relative to morality and war and so on.
Yes, yeah. Well, where can listeners find you, Jerry, on the web? I know that you have a page on creation.com. People can find you there. Is there other places that people can find you, articles?
Well, I'm on Facebook, which is easy to find.
Yes.
On Facebook, although I'm not really active on there. And I have a website, which I didn't set up. Somebody else did, but I think it's Dr. Jerry Bergman, Ph.D., they titled it. But plug my name and you get all kinds of stuff, both supportive and, of course, the atheists and agnostics out there are not too happy with what I'm doing, and so they can sometimes be quite nasty. And
sure.
And I guess that's a problem in supporting this area, that you end up with the atheists who aren't well known for their tactfulness and for their lack of kindness.
Yes.
Lack of kindness is sometimes pretty prevalent.
Yes. Well, I guess at least they're being consistent with their worldview if they're unkind, right?
Right, that's true.
Oh, my. Jerry, I really appreciate you joining me for this episode. It's been a great conversation. And, folks, again, get the book. It's a good read. It's an easy read, full of resources and research material. You can track those down for your own edification and equipping. C.S. Lewis, Anti-Darwinist, A Careful Examination of the Development of His Views on Darwinism, by Jerry Bergman. Jerry, thank you so much for joining me, and I look forward to our next conversation on some more of your books.
Okay. Thank you for having me on, and keep up the good work and keep working hard for the work of Christ.
Amen, brother. That's exactly right. I will do, and thank you. God bless.
Okay. Take care. We'll catch you later.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Soaring Eagle Radio is a production of Transforming Word Ministries and is released under Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivatives 4.0 International License. You may subscribe to the show on iTunes, follow us on Facebook where you can discuss this episode, and follow Soaring Eagle Radio on Twitter at Soaring Eagle Rad, and listen to every episode from our website, www.soaringeagleradio.com. The opening audio montage collection was created by Micah 68 Productions. Visit them on the internet at www.mika68.com for more information. Friends, remember the Apostle Paul's admonition to the believers meeting in Rome. Therefore, I urge you, brethren, by the mercies of God, to present your bodies a living and holy sacrifice, acceptable to God, which is your spiritual service of worship, and do not be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind, so that you may prove what the will of God is, that which is good and acceptable and perfect. I'm your host, Mike Spaulding. Thank you for joining us today for this edition of Soaring Eagle Radio.
Thanks for tuning in today to the Soaring Eagle Radio program. For more information about the show, write us at Soaring Eagle Radio, 682 West Grand Avenue, Lima, Ohio, 45801. You may also contact Mike directly by email at the following address, pastormike@woh.rr.com. God bless you today as you seek Him.